Hey gang out there in podcast land, this is Alex Lokes and welcome to the July episode of Classic Camera Revival, where we finally have lovely weather here in southern Ontario. It's about bloody time. And this month we decided to bring back one of my personal favorite things to do, and that is the Mystery Camera Challenge. So let's put on our sleuth hats and get going.
Coming to you live from Toronto, Canada, this is the Classic Camera Revival. If you don't have gear acquisition syndrome now, you certainly will after listening to our show.
Okay, so just as a reminder, if you remember our first Mystery Camera Challenge, what it essentially is we all bring a camera without telling the rest of our wonderful hosts here. We put our names in a hat. In this case, it was a lovely basket provided by the Red Harp Pub in downtown Acton, Ontario. We pick out a name and we shoot that person's camera and then talk about it. So let's get going and let's start with Donna.
Okay, so I had the joyous of shooting the lovely Voltlander Bessa R2M. Now, this camera is a beautiful, beautiful camera. I was actually a little worried about holding it and taking it out. It is extremely easy to focus, which I was shocked, especially because I wear glasses, and a lot of those cameras are not very easy for me without the optical lens. But extremely easy to focus. It was very easy to use. The lens is super sharp. I really can't wait to see my images.
Was there anything in particular about the camera that you weren't fond of?
To be honest, no. No, I liked everything about the camera. Yeah.
Now, this camera actually belongs to John. So this is one that is John's baby.
Yes, it's one of these cameras. You know, you buy a camera and sometimes, yeah, it's a good camera. It takes good images. I'm happy. And then there's a camera that instantly bonds with you. This is one of those cameras that has just that I've bonded with, and I love it.
Nice.
Yeah, no. I've had cameras like that also. The Nikon F2 is one that I've instantly bonded with as well.
And people have said about the Voigtlander line of rangefinder cameras that if Leica had taken this approach back in the early 1990s, the rangefinder market might have been different today. But it is sad that Voigtlander has stopped making rangefinder cameras. They're still making lenses, and the lenses are just absolute, like, they're not cheap. They're only cheap compared to Leica lenses, but it's some seriously beautiful glass.
Yeah. I was doing some reading recently on the history of Voigtlander, and it is the oldest camera manufacturer in the world. It started making mathematical instruments in the 17th century. So it's definitely a name that still carries weight even today, even though the cameras are being made by Cosina now, if I remember
correctly. It's Cosina, yeah.
I think they even look nicer than the Leica, to be honest, as well. And the fact that they're easier to load is, yeah, is a bonus, too.
Okay, so moving right along, we now have Mike, who also got to shoot a very special range finder.
I got my hands on Alex's absolutely lovely Contax G2. And right away, as soon as I picked it up, it was, maybe I'm supposed to have one, but I just cannot fathom dropping that much money on what's essentially a point and shoot. It, yep. For all intents and purposes, because that's pretty much what I found it was a point-and-shoot camera that kind of looks like a rangefinder and you can change the lenses on. Now, however, saying that, it's got a lot more ability to, a lot more functionality than any point-and-shoot that you may want to try to use. It has a fully manually controlled aperture, which the camera actually will meter for it. So I guess that would put it in aperture priority. You can also shoot it full manual by adjusting the speed dial from, I believe it says program or automatic, to any one of your shutter speeds from 1 second all the way up to 1/4,000th of a second, which is pretty impressive. Except what really impressed me more was when I had it on, I think it says auto, and I had it at F2, and it told me that it was set to 1/6000th of a second, which I was kind of shocked at. It was very surprising to see one that fast. Nonetheless, I could not get quite into fanboyism with it when I switched it from autofocus to manual. And that's where it suddenly became apparent that it has no characteristics whatsoever of a rangefinder. Because how do you focus? You do not get any kind of readout on whether you're actually in focus or not. There's no typical rangefinder image on image that you'd expect. In fact, it doesn't exist. All you have is a single dot in the middle of your screen, which is just a center point for focusing, or I should say for composition, and that's pretty much it. There is now, however, when you push the button on the back of the camera, right at the autofocus or manual focus, but the autofocus has continuous or single, as you'd expect for an autofocus, but it'll set the distance for you. However, this is great if you're taking a point shot and then adjusting it via a small dial on it and setting your range on it there, but it is not a camera to shoot manually. It's just that simple. Keep it in autofocus mode, do some street shots, do some portraits if you're so inclined, and it won't let you down. It's a really, really good camera with super fast autofocus, probably one of the fastest I've ever used when it comes to focusing, and it's pretty accurate. Plus, it also has parallax correction in the viewfinder, which I saw was pretty weird when you're looking at it in infinity and then you push the shutter button halfway down and all of a sudden the whole screen shifts and you're like, what happened? It's really cool, actually. And if you get a chance to hold on to one and try it out, go for it. But if you're actually looking at buying one, be expected to easily drop well over $1,000 for a kit.
Oh, definitely. And the autofocus is the part of the camera that does set it apart from other cameras of the era and of the format, but it's also its greatest weakness. And an interesting part about the viewfinder is that it's adaptive. So if I put the 28mm lens on it, the screen would adjust for the 28mm. So you were shooting with the 45mm f2, which is my favorite lens on that camera. It's the one that pretty much lives on it. And even though it has a Contax name, this is not a Zeiss Icon camera. It's it was manufactured by Kyocera, as were the lenses, but they are Zeiss design. They are licensed from Zeiss to be manufactured. And there's no difference between that Zeiss 45mm planar than the ones on my Rolleiflex and my Hasselblad.
Yeah, I've seen images that Alex has shared from it. I saw images that others have shared using this camera, and it's fantastic. It really, really is well built. The lenses are tack sharp, and the way it renders into the out of focus elements is pretty stunning. I mean, it's pretty typical Zeiss. When you look at Zeiss and you see it go from perfect tack sharp images as far as what's in focus to an absolutely seamless transition to what's out of focus, it feels really natural on the eye, which really sets Zeiss optics apart from pretty much everyone else, and I'd have to say even lights included. Like, don't get me wrong, lights optics are absolutely stunning. But I find Zeiss, it's just my own personal preference. I like the contrast Zeiss gives, and you do not get that with lights optics, which is kind of their trademark.
Okay, continuing around, next we have Bill Smith. And Bill Smith got to shoot a camera that I've had the pleasure of shooting, although I actually prefer the older version of the Contiflex Super.
Yeah, so I had an opportunity, and again, I've never shot with a Zeiss Icon Contiflex before, It was an utterly new experience. I needed a quick tutorial from Mike on how to load it and adjust aperture, shutter speed, and all that fun stuff. And then you realize, oh, it's a leaf shutter, unlike your standard horizontal curtain or, say, a vertical Kolpel shutter that you get on most SLRs since, I guess, the late 50s. So the Contiflex... It's not, oh my God, the viewfinder is just gorgeous. It's beautiful. Everything goes, snaps into focus really quick. I had the 35F3.2 Tesser lens on it. And it's like, it's only the front elements that are interchangeable. So that was really different. And then, it was my case. We shot on this is a really nice sunny day that we're doing this. So essentially just take your nice meter reading. Oh yes, it's roughly 1/250th F16. Off we went and just left it there. It was interesting working with a leaf shutter in a 35 mil format. I'm more used to that in medium format. I'm looking forward to seeing what I get from the end result. Now, it is a bit of a funky design. If you get one in the wild, I have no idea who can overhaul it.
There is a guy in the US, Zeiss, I believe he's ZeissCameras.com or something along. It's either ZeissIcon.com or ZeissCameras.com, and he services them. However, expect a waiting list. I've been waiting for my Contiflex Super B since I picked it up in 2013. It's now 2017. I'm still waiting. Unfortunately, he is literally the only guy in North America that can give these cameras a complete and total overhaul, all the way down to basically manufacturing parts. He can do it. He's got a lot of original parts from Zeiss for the contacts, for the Contiflex, for the Contessa. He's the guy to go to for these cameras. That said, you may be able to give it to someone else. Maybe they can work on it. Maybe they can't. They'll tell you if they can or can't. He is an older gentleman, so he's got a lot of years in the field of fixing these cameras, but he's also got what everyone would expect someone with that amount of years working with small, fine tools. He does have carpal tunnel in his hand, so it has slowed him down much more. But he is Zeiss trained, so he is very capable. However, I don't believe he's training an apprentice at this time.
Shame.
Yeah, which is a shame. Again, with the design with the Contiflex, and it was Zeiss's answer for the SLR, and now I know why Zeiss Icon isn't around anymore. Because if you look at it, I think that was the camera that killed the company. But then you look at the other German SLR of the day, which was the Leica Flax. It is much more a conventional SLR with match needle metering, and everything is where it's supposed to be. So you could literally pick one up and go off with it and not feel like, okay, where's that owner's manual again?
Yeah, definitely. And moving right along, John has a nice little camera. I've shot Ricohs before. They're a fantastic alternative if you have a lot of K-mount lenses but don't have a K-mount body.
Okay, I had fun shooting the Ricoh. It's XRP multi-program today. Now, I didn't play with all the modes. I just basically shot it in your standard aperture priority. There is an awful lot to like about this camera. I'm going to start off battery grip. Not all battery grips, in my opinion, are created equal in terms of how ergonomic they are. And this one fits the fingers beautifully. You pick up the camera, and it feels very... very natural. Like after a few minutes, the camera became transparent. I was just shooting with it and not really having to think about what I was doing. The viewfinder, you know, for I like this is not a pro camera. This would be like a sort of a budget or mid series. Very, very good viewfinder. The aperture and speed indicators, you can't miss them. They're very, very, especially the speed indicator along the right-hand side, very bright, very clear, but does not get in the way or take a lot of the viewfinder space. The aperture is sort of the standard, you know, reading the secondary scale off the lens in the bottom. So it's very, very good. One thing I noticed, and I didn't try it in, you know, like multiple shot mode, is when I was firing off single shots, it's a motor wind, or at least it has the motor wind attached. So it was motorized film advanced. It felt lackadaisical. Maybe that's the word I'll use. It wasn't like pow, pow, pow. It's like, it just sort of, okay, the shot's done. Let's just mosey on to the next one. And it felt a bit strange because it almost felt like I was taking a picture. I didn't want to move the camera until the film had finished winding, which of course doesn't make sense. Once it's wound, the shot's done. It just, I found that a little bit distracting. One other small thing, and yes, I know not all camera manufacturers follow the exact same standards and protocols, but I'm used to a lot of cameras where if you pull up on the film rewind lever, it pops the door open. But for this one, I had to pull up and then sort of manually open the door. And I could see that if Mike hadn't told me what I was doing wrong, I could see someone saying, how come the back door isn't, where the film door is an opening, and one could have an accident. But it's like once you know, no big deal. The finish, like it's not a metal monster. It's, you know, it's fantastic plastic kind of thing, but it feels solid enough. It's a very attractive camera, and like if you have a bunch of K-mount lenses, then to have a body like this as a secondary is not a bad way to go. So I really enjoyed shooting it. Good camera.
Yeah, and even the Rikonon optics were top notch as well. This camera came from Donna. So what does Donna think about this camera?
I absolutely love it. And as John said, the hand grip, it is very comfortable. I don't like a lot of hand grips either, and I was iffy on purchasing it, but it is very comfortable, and you really don't recognize that notice that you're holding it, which is very good. The images that you get, it's fantastic. I've never had any bad image. It's been pretty sharp. It's a nice little camera. I recommend anyone that needs a camera. It's low-budget camera, paid roughly around...
When we bought it, camera and winder, we may have spent $25 on, and the winder came brand new in box, was never used. I mean, it was still wrapped in plastic, still had all the foam inserts, and even the box was still taped closed. So that really said a lot for me. The most expensive thing on our kit that we picked up was when we picked up the lens last year at the big one by the Photographic Historical Society. And we paid about $50, give or take, roughly for it. And it's Vivitar 1.7, 50mm 1.7. And it is tack sharp. It really, really is a good lens. I would not be surprised at all if it was Chiron made, considering the amount of experience and really, really super lenses that Chiron has made in the past.
Definitely. One of my early zoom lenses was a Chiron, I think the 70-105 f4. On my SRT-102, and that lens pretty much stayed on the camera. It was just a brilliant lens.
I guess one thing I'd say about it, and it's not a knock against a specific camera, but against a type of camera, my guess is it's pretty electronic, so I'd assume that it's battery dependent.
100% battery dependent.
Does it have like a single manual speed if the battery dies, or is it okay?
No, it's just warm
up. Yeah, so there's that. And I guess the other thing, if it's an electronic camera of that era, you know, it's probably everything's on one board. And if the board goes, it's a paperweight. And because that's, you know, the Ryko, there probably isn't a Ryko guy, like the way there's a Canon guy or a Nikon
probably
guy.
Probably not.
Or is it Ryko? Am I saying Ryko? Oh, dear. Oh dear.
Like Rico Coliseum.
Okay. Oh, good to know. Yeah, that sort of makes sense. So a camera like that, you know, I wouldn't buy one, and I wouldn't pay a lot of money for it because, you know, when it goes, it's plastic, it's trash. But apart from that, fun little camera.
So the camera that I got to shoot is actually one that I've never shot before, but I have. And that sounds weird, but stay with me. Ashai got it right when they started making their SLRs. And sure, they had some fits and starts with their early Ashai Flexes, but as soon as they picked up that Pentax name, everything made sense. So I got to shoot Bill's Pentax H3. And if you are thinking, I've never heard of a Honeywell Pentax H3, you're probably right. This was the third of their Pentaprism SLRs that they ever produced. And this one is a Honeywell branded one, so it was one of the imports to North America.
Actually, a little footnote. Honeywell was the importer for Asahi Pentax into the U.S., so all the pre-Spotmatics and Spotmatics up until the early 70s were branded Honeywell, whereas the rest of planet Earth was Asahi.
And when I say it's a camera I haven't shot before, but I have, if you've shot a Spotmatic, you've essentially shot the H3. There's very little difference other than the fact that this one doesn't have a meter in it, which is fine. We shot it on a bright, sunny 16 sort of day. So I was pretty much shooting 1/250th at f/16 the entire time. And it was just an absolutely enjoyable experience. Of course, age has not been kind to the camera, and it probably skipped a few frames. But other than that, I really can't say anything bad about it. I'd probably still go for a Spotmatic before I picked up something of that age, but only because it's slightly newer and probably a lot more recognizable if it needed to be repaired.
Again, this H3, it's chronologically, it predates the S1A and the SV. You have to set the film counter yourself. That goes to show you how early it is. Probably around 1961, 1962. Again, this one I haven't really used that much, and I think it's probably the lack of use sort of, you know, it's
gummed
kind of
up
a little,
the works.
Maybe gummed up the works a bit. I have shot pre-Spotmatic Pentaxes, like the SVs, I've never had an issue with. I even own a Model K Pentax, which was only made for a year, and to find one, and if you find one on eBay, they usually start at around $500.
Yeah. But no, and I mean, you can use all your M42 Tacumar lenses on them, and there ain't nothing like those, especially when you get one slightly yellowed because of radiation.
Yeah, well, there is a little bit of an asterisk with the pre-Spotmatics. You got to be careful not to use the SMC.
Right, yeah.
Because on some of them, I think you can use them on the SVs, but something like the H3, stick to the Super Tacumars.
Yep. And again, nothing wrong with that. It was an enjoyable experience because, again, it was something that I was 100% familiar with. As soon as I picked it up, I'm like, oh, I know how to use this. So
I'd say to some extent, the reason why a Pentax Spotmatic feels so familiar is that, like, apart from, let's say, the pro-level Nikons and Canons, once the 60s got going into the 70s, the Spotmatic became a template.
Oh,
so many.
Absolutely.
Well, like, I have a Yashica Teal Electro, which was my first SLR with a teenager in the 70s, and it's basically a clone of the Spotmatic. And there are a lot of Spotmatic clones.
Oh.
Because they got the ergonomics right.
Yep, definitely. So, yeah, I think everyone won out this time around, unlike last year.
Yeah.
But I'm not bitter.
Not bitter at all. That's right. Okay, so.
Really?
Moving right along, now we talk about old cameras and all that fun stuff surrounding that, but a film that is near and dear to a lot of our hearts and unfortunately is no longer manufactured, but thanks to co-host James Lee, who unfortunately cannot join us today, We happened across an eBay seller who managed to buy out the entire warehouse when F-Key stopped production out in Croatia and has been selling bricks of F-Key 100 in 35mm on eBay for cheap. So no, we're not going to include that link because we want it all for ourselves. But F-Key is a very special film because it's made to formulas that just simply aren't done in film these days. Yeah, that's right. This film has heavy silver content, so it produces rich images. And as we get into the summer, it is just a beautiful film to shoot on these warm, bright, sunny days. So yeah, around the table, we've had a chance to shoot a lot of their different film stocks. I'm shooting through my brick of FQ100. I've shot the 25 in both 120 and even 4x5, and just an absolutely amazing film. Mike, what do you think about it?
The IR is it's unreal. It is like nothing I have ever shot before. I've shot the near IR films such as the Rolly ADS, Rolly IR. I've shot the Ilford SFX, and then when you shoot those, you find it's really neat. And then when you actually shoot the F-Key IR film, it takes you to a whole new level. It is unbelievable. It is so clean. It is so beautiful. I really wish if I could have figured out some way that I could have basically funded FCAT to keep their plant going. It's that good. It was just amazing. Now, they had another stock of IR that I never got a chance to shoot. That was purely just magic from everything I've seen. But I did shoot the non-Aura. I shot the regular stuff, which had an anti-halation backing, which was quite nice. You didn't get the glow, but you did get a super sharp, beautiful image, black skies if you really, really wanted to go that far. And the look was bar none, nothing I've ever seen. Now, of course, I've never shot the HIE, so I can't really speak on that. However, I did shoot it also in 35mm, and that was a learning experience because I had never shot IR film before. In a lot of ways, I had wished that I had heard Leslie speak of it before, Leslie Lazenby of the FPP. She spoke very clearly of never shoot IR film with a dimpled back. I didn't know, so I loaded the FCA IR 35 in my Yashica Lynx 14, which has a dimpled back.
Just to clarify, we're talking about the pressure plate.
The pressure plate, yeah. Absolutely. And needless to say, when I got the images back from, it wasn't Toronto Image Works, it was Silvano Color Lab. I took one look at the negatives, and I didn't really notice what I was really seeing until I scanned them. And when I looked at the negatives, I thought they were pretty nice. Sure, there was a little bit of a light leak, which I corrected on the camera. I wish I'd done it first. There were all sorts of little marks throughout the entire frame, every frame. And when I heard Leslie Lazenby a couple years later saying, never use a dimpled pressure plate shooting IR, I thought to myself, you know, I really wish I heard you say those words 2 years ago when I dropped $20 on this bloody roll of film. So needless to say, I was not a happy camper until I shot it in 4x5. And that's when my love for FCA just took off. And even shooting it as a non-IR film, stunning, stunning, stunning.
I shot a bit of, I'm not a regular shooter of F-Key, and I'm sort of late to start now. I have shot the IR Aura, I think a couple of rolls and a couple of sheets of the 4x5, and it's quite really, it's a unique film. It has a very, very specific look. Of course, it's, you know, the usual infrared look. You know, it has the wood, it has the whole thing. But because it doesn't have the anti-halation back layer, you get a glow that, quite frankly, you don't get with any other with IR film. It's sort of like, you know, polypan mixed with IR in a sense. I have one roll left in 35 millimeter. It wasn't particularly well stored, so I'm going to shoot it this year and this summer, and cross my fingers, because I don't know if you check out the usual price now, if you can find like old cold stored rolls of the Aura 820. It's right up there with some of the Polaroid or Fuji instant film in terms of price per box. I've also shot, it's been a while now, some of the F-Key did some 4x5, like they did this, say, an orthochromatic stock that I shot, and quite frankly, it was a disaster. The F-Key was very, very fragile, easily scratched, and I'm not the only person who have made that observation about F-Key film, but also, it didn't like the fixer. And this, you sort of got that fish scale metallic sheen on the fixer, which, you know, I tried another film. I thought, okay, well, my fixer must be bad, but it wasn't. So I still have some of this stuff at home, but it just sits there because I can't trust it. But the IR stuff, it's amazing. If you somehow come across a roll, and you know, take the proper precautions, like Mike said. One other thing I'd mention, in terms of the cameras it's suitable for, a lot of cameras have the little see-through convenience window on the back so you can tell what film stock. Put a couple of layers of electric tape over it because it's a pure IR film, and not like the Raleigh, you know, near IR. You really want to load it in the dark, unload it in the dark, and any little, like that little convenience window will conveniently give you a light leak. But apart from that, if you can try it, go for it.
One note about the fixer, and this isn't a problem with modern films, because you actually need to use a fixer that has a hardening agent with FK films. Modern films like your FP4, your T-Max, your Tri-X, your HP5 don't need that. But the early FKs and early ADOX films, you need to have a fixer with hardening. And thankfully, Kodak produces that.
Years ago, back in the late last decade, when FK was still in production, I shot a lot of FK 100 and also shot a lot of ADOX 100, which back then was rebadged FK 100. Beautiful film, and I was sad to hear when the plant closed beginning of the decade. So it was like, okay, another one gone. Oh, well, had fun. And then all of a sudden, when a few podcasts ago, when James let us know that there was an eBay seller out there who was sitting on a warehouse worth of FKKB 100, I just said, okay, I'm grabbing two bricks, and that'll be my victory lap. And it's been fun. Now, if you do stumble across this eBay seller, we won't say who it is because we don't want to make it too easy for you. this is a delicate film. Don't look at it the wrong way or it'll just give you grief. You want to load it in almost away from bright windows because, again, it's a thin base. You want to pre-soak it for a couple minutes just to soften up the layers a bit. Whatever developer you use, I've had good results in the past with Rodinal. This recently I've used HC110 Dilution B. Use a water stop. Do not use your regular Ilfo stop or your Kodak stop or diluted vinegar or whatever floats your boat in that regard. Use a water stop, then fix. Again, use a fix with a hardener and then rinse like you usually do, and perhaps squeegee with your fingers after the photoflow treatment, and you've got amazing looking negs.
Oh, absolutely. The shot that made me love FK films was actually my very last shot from a partially shot box of FK 25 and 4x5. I'd taken it down to Fort George in Niagara-on-the-Lake for one of their timeline events, and I got a shot of some reenactors portraying American airborne troops from the 101st, so World War II. And there was fogging on the one side of the film sheet, and it just made it look like it was shot in World War II because it had their camp behind it, and there was nothing anachronistic about it. And I was shooting in, my old modified anniversary speed graphic, so it had no focal plane shutter that had been stripped out. So when I say modified anniversary speed graphic, I mean heavily modified. But no, I'm glad I managed to pick up a brick. I've only shot one roll out of it so far. I plan on shooting more over the course of the summer.
One last thing. If you do stumble across this film, do not overexpose. Shoot box speed. In fact, shoot with a camera with a very accurate meter because, again, it does not like being overexposed. Not like regular film. You know, you got to treat this almost like pretend it's a slide film.
Yes.
When you're exposing absolutely. It. And then you'll be happy.
Yep.
I'd like to also recommend using a yellow filter with this film. Since it's very high silver content, it's also very blue sensitive. Yep. So expect blown out skies. Mm-hmm. So yellow filter or even a red. And it's like a whole new, like a completely different experience shooting this film. But
yeah, yellow 15 or an orange 22 would definitely help out.
Yeah. Yeah. Or polarizer even. Polarizer is very nice to use. I've shot the KB100 as well. And one other film I really mean to mention on is the EFCO 100R. I had the pleasure of shooting it in 127.
Okay.
When Silvano closed, I basically bought their entire remaining stock of it. And I'll definitely share an image from the EFCO 100R because I actually, one of my favorite images I ever shot with it was shot with John Strotola out in Niagara Falls. And nice. This film it's just beautiful. And I really do wish they were still around.
Well, the trouble is that their machines dated back to the 1940s and they simply couldn't get them maintained anymore. It was a mechanical beast and it ran out of time. That's an unfortunate nature of the beast. But if it's not exact same, but I've had the chance to shoot the ADOX CHS-102 and it's an absolutely beautiful film in 4x5. I haven't shot it in 35mm, but in 4x5 it's brilliant and definitely worth picking up if you miss the EFCO. Well, that about wraps it up for this show. Have a great summer, everybody. I got nothing clever to say. Wow.
Sunny 16 or go home.
This is John Meadows. A film that needs a hardening fixer? What the EFCO?
This is Donna Bataxi. Have a great summer and keep that film rolling.
This is Mike Bataxi, and keep those shutter firing.